I'm Heba Elias.
And I'm Siobhan Drew.
And welcome to Momentum, a Race Forward podcast, where we explore how racial justice work
is showing up everywhere around us.
Hey, it's Dennis, and I'm back again on Momentum, a Race Forward podcast.
First, welcome back from sabbatical, Heba. Oh my gosh, I'm so glad that you were able to get the time off. How was it?
It was amazing. If I can grant everyone sabbaticals under all professions, I think 3 months isn't enough time. I got to travel back home to Sudan to see family. I got to spend the month of Ramadan in peace and not have to work all day. And now I'm back. And upon my arrival, Siobhan has departed for her sabbatical, and I'm super excited for her. I hope that she's enjoying herself. I'm hoping that she's doing everything that she's wanted and just taking really, really good care of herself. So I'm excited.
Yes, I hear that. Grounding, peace, and care, especially in the past year that we've had. You know, all of the shit gets so heavy, and the ability to have a break and a paid break at that for 3 months is such a gift. And I would argue an imperative in this moment if all of us are going to be in this fight for the long haul. So I am just so glad that you had it. I'm glad that Siobhan has had it. And I'm just looking forward to you both being back here, refreshed, and back on the podcast. But in the meantime, really happy to fill in. I get to be on this podcast with you. First, it was with Siobhan, and that was a dream. And now with you, and I'm just really excited for the next couple of episodes that I'm going to be joining you all.
I am too. First, I gave you a personal shout out behind the scenes, but Dennis, I really want to give you a public shout out and a public thank you for really stepping in and stepping up and seeing us through. Speaking of last couple of months, there are a lot of updates, a lot of news on what's going on. Obviously, COVID is still real. It's still a thing and it's still here. But Dennis, I would love to hear if you can give us an update on what's going on currently, if you have any news that you want to share with our listeners.
Yeah, I mean, I just think about this past summer. I live in New York City. And, you know, when the vaccines were all available to us earlier this year, I was like, this is going to be hot girl summer. You know, I'm going to be out and about. I'm going to be reliving my 20s. And the fact is that the pandemic, it just hasn't worked out that way. That because the virus has been allowed to spread so much, we're getting all of these mutations. And so one of them, the Delta variant, has been ravaging this country, allowed to go unspread, mostly amongst the unvaccinated population at this point. And so, you know, for us, it has halted the type of progress that cities, counties, and this whole country had for reopening the economy, you know, at least here in New York City. And I know a lot of folks don't have access to insurance, but anywhere that you can have trusted medical folks, I'll just say, like, there are so many doctors, scientists of color out there right now that are just like, hey, you know, we know the history of all of medical racism. We know the hesitancy. We know that government has a long history, not just of experimentation on Black and brown bodies, but also not having legit healthcare in those communities too. And here we are telling you that we have done our due diligence, right? And so this is why it is important for you and your family and your community. So something that we are battling against now.
I'm hoping that people educate themselves and spread the word amongst their families, their friends, and do what they think is best for them, right? I don't want to be the one to be like, go get vaxxed, you know? Whatever you feel is best for you, just make sure you're educated and that you're aware on what's going on. The next thing in my mind is climate change, right? We've experienced intense flooding this last week from Hurricane Ida, and not only us, a few other cities and states as well that were heavily impacted by Hurricane Ida, Philadelphia, Connecticut, and New Jersey, to name a few. It was really scary, right? I live in Coney Island, which is located in Brooklyn, New York. The beach is right up the block from me. So Hurricane Sandy was a sad moment, but really impacted the community in a bad way, right? We were underwater for a good 36 hours. And personally for me, I've grown PTSD from any hurricane news since Hurricane Sandy. So when Hurricane Ida hit without any notice, I was immediately shocked. Sadly, I'm not the only one that experienced that. Luckily, Coney Island wasn't underwater, but a lot of communities were underwater. I've seen, you know, images of my friends in Philadelphia who have been showing me their yards, you know, their main streets that was underwater for about 2 to 3 days. It's actually killed up to 43 people, right? And a lot of the folks that unfortunately perished were in basement apartments with no way to evacuate their homes. So it was a very scary week. And I feel like this particular hurricane brought major attention to the climate change that's happening, not only in, you know, the States, but worldwide.
Yeah. Oh my gosh. This moment coming off of the heels of another climate change report that says, basically, you know, we should have done all of this stuff yesterday, right? And here are the new benchmarks in order for us to avert, you know, absolute climate disaster. You know, this is really personal. You know, of the people that died, there is a Nepalese family that lives 3 blocks from me, a mother, a father, and their 2-year-old child that died because they were in a basement apartment that flooded. And that is just like, I know the Nepalese community where I live is just so tight. And to see the systemic failure, the failure of infrastructure, mitigating the impact of climate change, the deadly impact of climate change, it is just incredibly heartbreaking. It's just so important to remember again that we are interconnected and we have work to do. Oh my God, there's just, you know, again, this is why sabbaticals are necessary. I talked about this in previous podcasts, but the fight against the attacks on critical race theory, you know, as another tool of the political elite in the culture war to distract and divide us. It's just like in the midst of all of the things that we're talking about, climate change, COVID, that this is something that political elites are really trying to make into a controversy. You know, it still boggles my mind. And every single time I think about it, when I think about the world, I am just like, I can't believe this is what we need to focus on. And at the same time, it really is important because the attacks on critical race theory, they are fundamentally attacking the idea that systemic racism exists. And if you deny the fact that systemic racism exists, then all of the remedies, reparations, $9 billion to Black farmers and the American Rescue Plan, for example, that becomes unnecessary. It becomes illogical if systemic racism doesn't exist. And so for us, we have skin in the game. And I would argue that all of us, including white people, have skin in the game. Because if we don't know our history, then we actually can't repair the harms of history that we're living through. Anyway, dang, I'm getting all worked up, Hiba.
We can definitely dedicate an episode entirely to critical race theory because I feel like there's so much to unpack. So I'm actually looking at our producer, Hendel. He's not on the screen, but I know you hear me. Let's dedicate an episode to this so we can really sit and unpack and hopefully have a guest that's going to help us unpack because this is deep, this is dense, and we could sit here all day and talk about it, to be honest with you, Dennis. It's so many things I feel like that are taking place simultaneously across the seas. And the one thing that right now is near and dear to my heart, Tigray, Ethiopia, I feel like what's happening over there isn't spoken about in the degree that it's supposed to be spoken about. It is a modern day genocide happening, unfortunately. You know, shortly after the election, the U.S. elections, hearing from family and friends that are Ethiopian, the internet became, of course, it's a form of communication for all of us to communicate back home. And that's not the case for our friends in Ethiopia right now. Their prime minister has shut off all telecommunications in Tigray, which many thought was an excuse to commit atrocities like in the dark. Recently, I was watching a documentary on CNN where, you know, bodies are floating in a common water between Sudan and Ethiopia, and they're connecting the dots to Tigray, to the small village where they're keeping many folks hostage. And all of this is not being spoken about. Many don't know about it. I'm doing my part today just to kind of spread the word on our Momentum podcast for folks to really go get educated. Please spread the word.
Yeah. Speaking of political turmoil, you know, again, abroad, globally, countries across the globe are really contending with this moment. And what does it mean to govern during a pandemic? You know, especially when we are all thinking about revolution, when we're all thinking about transformation of our society, what is it going to take? And what is the arc of history? And so, you know, I think this is just a call for us to pay attention to what's happening abroad. And so the last thing that we wanted to mention that's happening today, that we wanted to call into the space as context for what we have been thinking about over the summer, is the withdrawal of troops from Afghanistan. It has been a huge event, not just for people in Afghanistan, but for people here, and I would guess people abroad too, who are paying attention. And again, it's, you know, it was a long time coming, a 20-year war that we should not have been in the first place. You know, I think for some, it's kind of like the challenge of American hegemonic power, imperialist power. And I'm like, it's about time. And so, you know, I'm really excited of this moment of where we're actually talking about America's place in the world and really nipping the bud at this idea of American exceptionalism and recognizing that, yo, we have work to do here. So there's just so much to talk about. And this was just the flavor, you know, like it was just the amuse-bouche, the tip.
I echo and second everything that you've named. I feel like America has their hands dipped in everyone else's pots. And there's so much work to do in our own communities. There's so much work to do here. But I can't help but feel, you know, sadness to see what's going on in the land of Afghanistan and folks who are on the grounds there. You know, my friend works for Port Authority and the Border Control, and he's been telling me there's flights coming in back to back with refugees. And it makes me happy that folks are able to leave the grounds to come and start a new opportunity. But I'm calling for everyone that are on the grounds here, please have an open heart to welcoming these refugees who are now our neighbors, right? So any way that you can help, you know, donation of clothes, food, shelter, there is information online for how you can help. Please go seek that information and do your part. We all have backgrounds. We all have different ethnicities. We all come from motherlands, right? It takes a helping hand to get you situated, right? And standing on your 10 toes. So please do your part in any way you can to help our friends flying in from Afghanistan. And I'll just leave it there because I feel like we could talk about this all day too, Dennis. So for today's interview, Dennis, you had a chance to talk to Eric Ward. I'm excited about this. Let's listen in.
Eric K. Ward has a long and distinguished career as a social justice advocate, working with local, state, and national organizations to implement strategies for change around racial justice and immigrant rights. Eric brings over 30 years of leadership in community organizing and philanthropy to his roles as Western State Center's executive director and senior fellow with Southern Poverty Law Center and here at Race Forward. Eric is the author of multiple written works, including Skin in the Game, How Anti-Semitism Animates White Nationalism. He has been quoted in The New Yorker, New York Times, Los Angeles Times, Rolling Stone, and other media outlets. He is regularly published on Medium, check him out, and the Oregon Way blog, and is working on a forthcoming documentary about whiteness and race in America. So Eric, welcome.
Dennis, it's such a pleasure to be here. It's great to hear your voice. Thank you for the invite.
I was really intent on having you on Race Forward's Momentum podcast because I've just learned so much from hearing you speak and reading your work. I know that you and I teamed up with Kimberly Crenshaw of the African American Policy Forum to talk about the attacks on critical race theory. And you recently spoke at Race Forward's all-staff retreat a week ago. You know, we didn't have a chance to talk about this, Eric, but I just wanted to say that your words, they helped me understand the moment that we're in and what we need to focus on collectively as a racial justice movement. So I wanted to take the time to first say thank you.
Look, such a pleasure. And this panel that took place with Kimberly Crenshaw looking at the attacks on public education, right, to turn critical race theory, a legal theory, into kind of a racist dog whistle has played out in all the ways we pointed to in that panel almost 6 weeks ago, how you spoke to the need for people to engage around understanding. This had nothing to do with critical race theory. This is everything about a conversation around race equity. I just thought was extremely powerful. I hope folks remember that in this moment. I hope that's the answer to a lot of the questions that are happening right now.
Yeah. No, thank you, Eric. That is high praise coming from you. And, you know, when I remember what you brought to that panel, and I think even not just that panel, just in every space that you're in, you are so good at setting the political context, talking about the moment in history. So that leads me to my first question for you. You know, I feel like we are living through multiple crises. Every single time I open up the New York Times or any other publication, there's another atrocity, there's another tragedy. And so, you know, it helps me to think about Grace Lee Boggs. And she would ask a big question during crises like this. She would ask, what time is it on the clock of the world? And so I would love to hear you respond to that, given the moment that we're in.
Yeah. You know, it's interesting. I used to hear her use that as a reference, right? And one time I heard her say that with veterans of the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee. She was in a grouping of folks just talking. And it immediately made me think, Dennis, of the kind of nuclear clock. Right? Scientists have a thing called the nuclear clock. And anytime that it's 2 minutes to midnight is a warning that we need to be really concerned. But the way Grace Lee Boggs frames it is in a very different way. Those of us who want a world where everyone can live, love, worship, and work free from fear, like in a way, she's kind of asking us, what time is it in terms of where we are? And the interesting thing is, if I were going to use that nuclear clock, I would actually say, I would flip it and say, we're actually at 1201 right now in this country. And it's not a bad thing, right? That decades of struggle for racial equity and gender and economic equality in this society actually have advanced us, right? We actually are in a new moment due to those sacrifices and struggles. But yet we are meeting a backlash that's trying to push us back to 1159. And that's what's going on in the world right now. And it's playing out in this country around COVID. It's playing out in this country around the political violence, the attempt to overthrow the elections. But we see it in day-to-day too, right? The resistance to equality and education and transportation, housing. Most of the things we're experiencing in this are because our movements for justice and equity have been successful. And what we're facing is a backlash because of those successes. No good deed goes unpunished. Mm,
that's right. And speaking of backlash, I'm also reminded of the words of the Reverend Dr. William Barber. He talks about the third Reconstruction, that we are currently in it. And the first one being the moment in time occurring after the abolition of slavery, and the second and the events leading up to and during the civil rights movement. And at each of those reconstructions, there was backlash, right? When we were at 1150, they got us back to 1149, to use your analogy. I mean, you talked about sacrifice and struggle of our elders, and we cannot forget about that. And so if we were going to use that frame, you know, we're in a third reconstruction right now. What do you think we can learn from the first two reconstructions?
Yeah. So when we think about reconstructions in the United States, we think, or even just in the history of this country, we think of like two very specific moments. We think of the period immediately following the Civil War, right? The deconstruction, the attempt to deconstruct the legal system of slavery in this country. And then in the 1960s, you see the second reconstruction, which is an attempt to deconstruct Jim Crow, racial segregation. And it brings us to now the third piece. Can we secure the idea of common humanity, right? The idea of fundamental human and civil rights. And can we propel that into a society whose systems and values align around that? And, you know, to make that plain, here's what's interesting. The reconstruction that's happening in the United States, a third reconstruction, is can we have an actualized, inclusive democracy that is people-centered, transparent, and accountable? And within that, can we establish system of governance who prioritize that as what it means to be a healthy society? And that's what's happening around us right now. There are folks who say yes. There are some folks who say no. And the folks who say no appear once again to be willing to use violence and intimidation and threats in order to halt the future. But here's the deal. You can't stop the future. You can slow it down. But the struggles that have occurred and the struggles that will occur will continue to advance not only the society, but other societies around the world towards equality and equity. The barrier to that right now is still the system of racial and ethnic and caste discrimination. These systems prevent us all from actualizing our humanness, not just those of us who are on the receiving end of it, but those who benefit from it as well.
Hearing you talk about that makes me think of the question, can we become a just multiracial democracy in which we all thrive? That seems to be the perennial question in which all of these crises fall under. And so I'm glad that you brought up democracy and the intersection between democracy and race, because I feel like we are coming up with these questions all of the time. The ways in which we cannot achieve a full democracy because of systemic racism, and the ways in which race is used as a wedge to destroy democracy. Like, we're seeing two sides of the same coin. I want to hear from you. If our vision is a just, multiracial, democratic society in which we all thrive, how are we seeing that vision under threat currently? And what are those threats?
Yeah, those threats are significant. And we should understand this threat didn't start 4.5 years ago with the arrival of Donald Trump to the White House. It is a threat that has been long in the making. Look, the gist of it is in the 1960s, we have a movement called the Civil Rights Movement that is serious about voting rights, desegregation of housing, employment, and very serious about investments in economic and other forms of social equity in the society to try to repair the harm that was done through hundreds of years of racial segregation and terror under slavery and under Jim Crow. Look, those advancements paid off in lots of ways, not just for Black folks, not just for people of color, but for all Americans. I can point to states in this country where white people benefit more from the civil rights and its victories of the 1960s than even people of color do in some of those states. That is the universalism of racial justice in this country. It lifts everyone up. So we have these victories. And of course, those who benefited most from racial exclusion policies, those who benefit from being able to divide communities, Black and white or Latino and Asian against one another in order to distract us from policies that harm us all, right? Continue to try to stir attention. You also have movements that reject the idea of multiracial inclusion. The white nationalist movement that saw the civil rights movement not as a victory, but as a defeat, right? Who have sparked their own revolutionary movements. And these movements are afoot. They're seeking, right, to deny what is a victory for racial justice. They have done that through violence. They've done that through reactive policies. But here's the deal, Dennis. We have to keep our eyes on the prize. These folks are losing, so they're going to throw everything at the window. How do I know they're losing? Because right now in the United States, more white Americans are supportive of Black Lives Matter by percentage than were ever supportive of Martin Luther King Jr. during his entire life, right? And at no time in his life did he ever receive the majority of the white vote in this country. Yet, Black Lives Matter has 48% of the white vote in this country, meaning it has supported the majority of Americans in this country. That is quite significant. And that shows us how far we've come, but there will be backlashes. So what do we do? We have to be vigilant. I tell folks we have to take on two tasks in this moment. The first is that we have to continue the urgent work of working on racial equity and other forms of social justice. This is how we begin to provide a real alternative, right? We have to understand the alternative to the white nationalist violence is not the status quo. The status quo is not a place most Americans want to go. And so we have to give an alternative. And I think that is that multiracial democracy. We have to give folks a chance to practice that. So we continue the work of ensuring voting rights. We continue the work of making sure that there is access, right? Equitable access in the areas of transportation, housing, education, jobs. We don't forget about the climate, right? We have to have a planet if we're going to practice democratic governance. And so we keep focusing on those policies and practices that are so critical to getting us to the future. The second thing we do, though, is we understand there is another social movement on the terrain, and it is not one grounded in inclusion, but one that is grounded in exclusion. And we can't ignore that movement. We have to begin to try to manage the backlash as well. If we don't manage that backlash, what we know is that a movement could take root, right? That could undo all the work that many of us have invested in over the years. As we said, those who came before us have invested in over lifetimes.
Yeah, absolutely, Eric. And speaking of which, I know that the Western State Center, which you are the executive director of, you recently released a statement when the Proud Boys staged a rally in Portland. And so could you just share with our listeners a little bit about what Western State Center is and a little bit about what happened in that moment when the Proud Boys pulled up and what it portends for all of us?
Absolutely. Western State Center is a progressive civil rights pro-democracy organization that is based in Portland, Oregon. We work primarily on the ground in the Pacific Northwest and Mountain States region, but we work nationally, meaning we understand we're in a region, but our region is part of a country. And so we work with organizations and networks across the region, with organizations like Race Forward, in order to advance policies and grassroots advocacy that expand racial and gender equity. And we believe defending systems of governance are important to that equation. Look, at the end of the day, government is the highest form of mutual aid, right, that we are able to conceive of in the moment. And it is one that helps meet the needs of a global society and of our own country. Western State Center works each and every day investing in leaders, investing in organizations, engaging in culture and narrative conversations in order to expand that conversation on what is a democracy? What does it look like? What does it mean to be an American? What will America look like? And to begin to put that look like into daily practice. We do that through trainings. We do that through advocacy campaigns and research and education. The Pacific Northwest has been dealing with an incursion, almost an insurgency of authoritarian paramilitary organizations. And some are armed, some are unarmed. And they have been targeting Portland now for nearly 6 years with regular incursions into the city, attacking people with physical violence, etc. The latest has taken place a few weeks ago where there was a paramilitary rally. It was met by counter-protesters. There were physical fights in the neighborhood. And it was, once again, unsurprising. We had seen this unfolding for quite a time. But we think something has gotten lost, right? There's lots of debate, Dennis, around how we respond to this as a community. And Western State Center has some thoughts on this. But we thought something was really getting lost, particularly in the Portland story. Everyone kept looking at events in Portland as if it was a Portland problem, right? That this merely had something to do with Portland, Oregon. And Western State Center felt it was important to remind Portlanders, Oregonians, Northwesterners, and the entire country, right, that this wasn't a Portland problem, that this was a national problem in which Portland had been abandoned to try to address itself. What we are seeing around the country is a right-wing authoritarian backlash to to multiracial democracy and to what it perceives to be an United States government that is sympathetic to multiracial democracy. And it is used bombings, it is used murders, it is used beatings, it is used harassment in order to disrupt that. And it's happening not just in Portland, but around the country. And so folks kept looking at Portland saying, why can't Portland get its act together? And I'm like, Los Angeles has lots of resources. Los Angeles County has some of the best folks elected in government and around government. And I thought, if Los Angeles County can't get together on this, if this is too big for Los Angeles, how can folks think that Portland can solve this on its own? So our letter was just a warning both to state and federal governments that it was time to step up. Stop abandoning cities in which we know that the alt-right has said to journalists for years that they were targeting for disruption. We have to stop looking at them as if it is merely a problem of Portland, Oregon. But there's an underlying piece to this, Dennis. There's something else we have to hold. As we deal with these insurgencies, and trust me, if this were happening in another country, right? If these things were happening in another country, we'd all understand what we were seeing, right? We'd be able to name it in a second. But here we have a harder time. So we have to take on those insurgencies, and it's state and federal government. It is their responsibility to step up. And, you know, we all need to be asking, where are they, right? As school board members are being threatened, high school students are being physically attacked, where is the federal government? Where are state governments? And as we take on that insurgency, we have to deal with the underlying problems, because I always tell this story of a white nationalist activist who I saw being recorded at a protest probably over 4 years ago. And he was being asked why he had come to Portland, right? No one wanted him in Portland, the guy with the camera said to him. And the white nationalist said back to him, yeah, I've heard we're not wanted in Portland. But then he went on and said, but did you know Portland is one of the few cities in America with a shrinking Black population by whole number and percentage? And then he said, so you can say you don't want us here, but you're doing something we can never get away with. You're actually disappearing Black people. That was his response. And what we can take from that is that he's calling us hypocrites. And if we don't make real racial equity and opportunities in our community, we're never going to have effective responses to these insurgencies, because these groups don't come to town bringing racism or anti-Semitism or homophobia or Islamophobia with them. They simply organize the bigotry that already exists. At the end of the day, if white nationalists are targeting Portland, it's because they feel somewhere there's a home here for them. And it's the job of state and federal government to work with the city of Portland to show that that's absolutely not true. Not just criminal, but dealing with the longstanding inequality.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, it's just wild. It's kind of like clockwork to me, the ways in which white nationalists and white nationalist adjacent folks use and leverage resentment, including but not exclusively racial resentment, to put a wrench in the gears of our work, to stop the work of racial equity. I'm just heeding the words that you were saying. It's, you know, part of this backlash moment is to stop that work and for us to continue this work of making real racial and gender equity. And, you know, you talked a little bit about the importance of governance. You know, it's always a good reminder. I think you said this during a retreat too, that white nationalists are unapologetic about getting power too. So they are going after school boards. They are going after local governments, like actually running candidates. And somehow we put our hands up and say, you know, we're not going to fight for that territory. Given, you know, all of this, given the connection between race and democracy and the moment that we're in, I wonder if you have any closing thoughts, you know, to our listeners who are racial justice organizers and activists. What would you say to them in this moment?
Yeah, I would say don't get deceived in this moment. This is a moment that we are dealing with where there is a great backlash. And backlash doesn't always look the ways we think, right? The ways we get conditioned to accept backlash. You know, when I was really young, you know, you learn about slavery, right? Being Black, I heard about it from my parents, but, you know, you also start to learn about it at school and you learn things like, oh, it was illegal for Black people who were held in captivity to read, right? That these were part of the what were known as the slave codes. And you would always read in school that if you got caught reading, you could be beaten, you could be punished, you could be killed, right? All kinds of things could happen to you. And I used to think that was the way they got Black people not to read. I thought that was the primary way. And then I was talking to a historian who said, actually, the primary way that they got Black folks not to read was to undercut what it meant to read, right? They would make fun of reading in front of Black folks. They would get Black folks to make fun of other Black folks who were reading, right? They socialized people to not want to read. And, you know, this is a real message for racial justice and racial equity folks. We live now in a moment where the very things we should be fighting for are the things we have been conditioned to roll our eyes at. And so I'll give some examples, right? We roll our eyes at the idea that running for office is somehow a weak response to this moment. It's not a militant or radical or revolutionary thing to do. And so we roll our eyes at it. Meanwhile, this other movement, as you said, it continues to build at all areas of governance, right? Because they understand it is easier to tear down a multiracial democracy that is trying to birth itself into being by controlling the apparatus of government than being outside. They tell us that voting doesn't matter, and we call it like mainstreaming or selling out, right? Buying into a corrupt system. Meanwhile, these folks are doing everything they can at the local and state level to prevent voting, right? And then, you know, the biggest illusion, it is that democracy is somehow a weak idea. But the truth is, democracy has delivered more in terms of racial equity in the society than any other ideology that has ever existed, right? And democracy in America is primarily an ideology built through Black struggle in this country. And I think it is the ideology of this modern day struggle, but we've been socialized to see it as something else, right? Something corrupted. So I tell folks in this moment, I'm not saying don't be urgent. I'm not saying to not speak truth to power, but don't be so quick to dismiss, right? Those things that we have struggled so hard to build, because I believe those things we have built are the very things that will carry us forward and ensure that we stay at 1202.
Gosh, Eric, thank you so, so much. Again, I continue to learn from you. And I just wanted to thank you on behalf of Race Forward for joining us on this podcast. So how can our listeners find you?
So you can find me over on Twitter at Bulldog Shadow. Bulldog Shadow was going to be my pro wrestling name when I was 7. So folks can find me over there. Twitter's close to wrestling. And you can find me over at westernstatecenter.org. Phenomenal organization, phenomenal national network, proud partners of Race Forward. Come find us.
Yeah. And Eric, speaking of Bulldog Shadow, that's your alias for, I mean, I know you're a singer-songwriter too. Is that right?
That's what I claim, and I'll let other folks judge, but I do love picking up the guitar and writing some music, and every once in a while, folks let me play it live on stage. It's not so bad.
Great. Where can we listen to you?
Oh, you can find me, I bet, on iTunes and cdbaby.com and probably Spotify. Yeah. Leave me a note. Let me know what you think.
You know, if it's anything like what you're sharing now on this podcast or, you know, in other places where I hear you speak or read what you write, then I'm sure it's brilliant. And we'll make sure to link to it in our show notes. And just wanted to say, you know, it's just like walking the talk, Eric, not only speaking truth, but using the power of arts and culture to move a different set of narratives in the world of joy, of resistance, that a better world is possible. So thank you for cultivating that joy.
Such a pleasure. And thanks for being such an anchor out there, you and all the good folks at Race Forward. Such an important moment and such an important organization.
That was an awesome interview, Dennis. Thank you so much. Eric, shout outs to you. Super happy to have you on the Momentum podcast with us. A few updates for all of our listeners. Race and Our Present, Our Future is happening on September 25th. It is going to center the racial justice work of Black and Indigenous youth aged from 13 to 25. The content will be youth-focused, but the audience will be all ages. It's going to elevate how youth and young adult activists are using organizing, art, cultural narrative, and policy strategies to strike powerful blows to structural racism in the U.S. and continue the global movement to defend Black lives. This virtual event is presented by Race Forward and the Funders Collaborative on Youth Organizing. Please visit our website at raceforward.org, get registered, join us. I would love for you to come join me and my team who have been working diligently on producing this event. Come show us some love and vibe out with us on 25th. Looking forward to having you.
Thank you, Hiba, and shout out to the conferences and convenings team for killing it. If you are looking to deepen your understanding of racial equity and racial justice and what you can do about it, we have public trainings. They are called our Building Racial Equity Trainings, or BRE for short. And so if you are looking to sign up, you and your colleagues, you and your friends and family, go to raceforward.org/trainings.
So Dennis, we are celebrating 40 years of Race Forward. Shout outs to everyone on staff, shout outs to past staff. I just want to let everyone know that we will be hosting the 40th anniversary virtual gala event on November 18th. It will be live casted on our YouTube and on our Facebook. Please join us. It's going to be a phenomenal celebration. We're going to have some special guests, some special performances, and you don't want to miss it. So stay tuned, stay plugged in with us for more updates, but just mark that date on your calendar, November 18th.
Speaking of being plugged in, being part of the Race Forward community, if you haven't already, please visit our social media at Race Forward on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram.
Also, if you love listening to us, we are on Apple Podcasts, we are on Spotify, we are on Pandora. Please rate, subscribe to our Momentum podcast. So please tap in, let us know how you feel, and we're looking forward to having you listen in on the next episode.